Unlike most of it, I give a large extensive test of Makara. You come to the DNA there in DNA one, well, it'll be 17 different traditional Makara we'll be going through. That's not what this is, partially because of the lens that's going to be doing a session like that, which I've been at next class, and we don't want to be redundant. So this is transformative philosophy lecture. And therefore, I'm also not going to try to give you a fair survey of Jewish positions on the issues. What I'm going to try and do is advocate for a particular approach. Okay? So I want to just be upfront about that. First of all, you have to be set intellectually to be thinking high-level abstractions. And secondly, I'll leave it to you to figure out in the end whether what I'm saying is really traditionally justifiable. You can go through all the parts, and you can decide whether it is or not. I think obviously it is. What I want to do is find a way to think through the issues. And I want to begin with a section from a novel by Simon Bacharach that I read years ago. It's report number one. I read years ago, and as always, I would say, probably for the last 25, 26 years, and I always come back to it as a way of touching base with my own thinking about these issues. I'm going to read it here. And this is from a novel called In the Beginning, where the central figure is a student who is struggling between traditional yeshiva education and academic Bible studies, as opposed to the chosen of the Talmud for academic Talmud studies. In the beginning, he ventures into the really dangerous waters of academic Bible studies. And he has a conversation with a character who is, I think, generally considered to be top fantasy in the row. He's supposed to be a revelation. Now, I don't know that Rick Elish ever said something like the way he says to the student here. There are many times in my life where I wish it had been true. That's where he's coming from. Right? This is sort of Tata's imagination of what the Rav should have said to a student who is facing this issue. Okay, so he says, the Rebbe will give you things that I told him. Right, when I'm doing academic Bible study, and I mentioned the question that is on my mind too much tonight. When he stopped at the corner of the West Coast path, he turned towards me contemptuously. I will not investigate your citizenry. That is between you and your obligations to the past. Are you telling me that you won't be telling this book? Obviously, that's not like I can translate, but you can I'm not telling you anything that. What are you telling me? I'll go wherever the truth leads me. A secular scholarship, friend, is not the scholarship of tradition. In secular scholarship, there are no boundaries and no permanently fixed views. Lurie, if the Torah cannot go out into your world of scholarship and return stronger, then we are all fools and charlatans. I have faith in the Torah and not afraid of truth. I always love that line. I wish the Rav had said that. If the current cannot tell us what, is your world of scholarship and return stronger, then we are all fools and charlatans. I have faith in the Torah, I am not afraid of truth. Okay, so that I think is a really useful text to keep in mind to start with, but I want to start breaking it down philosophically. What does it mean to say, I have faith in the Torah, I am not afraid of truth? And that gives you a definition of faith. Right? To have faith is to not be afraid of truth. Okay, now the question is, why should one not be afraid of truth? How can one not be afraid of truth? So what are your options? Yeah.
Then being afraid of truth is philosophy.
Okay, afraid of truth. Right now, what kind of person would get to and say, I'm afraid of the Jack Nicholson, right? You can't handle the truth.
Okay. Well, I had someone speak to a group I was talking to who said that who characterized the Orthodox position as you keep one little part of your mind separate to hold on to Torah, you know, and then the rest of your mind is free to do what it needs to do, And that is mean to keep this a fear of truth, because it says if I open that door somehow, the questions I ask won't have an answer within the book.
Okay, good, right, and we'll get to that in a second. So let's take this story. One notion, that means I'm not afraid of truth, is we should take this one step back. This is a really dangerous statement because it implies that where can truth be found? Truth can be found outside Torah. Right? Truth can be found in academic fellowship, and I'm not afraid of truth. Right? But that concedes that, right, that the results of academic methodology are truth. And I'm not afraid of truth. But you could think of people saying, for example, that I'm not afraid of any external demonstration. Right, that something might be true, because no matter what you show to me, my faith will withstand it. Right, I can say, I'm not afraid of what about your truth, because my truth is truer than your truth. Right, that's one kind of approach. The second kind of approach is, I can say, I have complete faith that if you use your methodology properly, it will not reach conclusions that contradict what I already believe. And that's the second degree of faith, because I know the story is true, but if your methodology is true, it could not possibly yield results that contradict me. Okay, third, when I'm in trouble, in fact, it doesn't. Right, then my response will be, you must be doing your own methodology badly. Right, because if you're doing your methodology properly, right, I'm not afraid of truth. Right, there's a third possibility, which is that I can say I have faith that whatever truth you come up with, I can reinterpret Torah so that it coordinates with it. I also I'm not afraid of truth. Now, those are all psychological responses, all of which can generate the sentence, I have faith in Torah, but I'm not afraid of truth, but they yield very, very different substantive results. And that should alert us to the need for precision and rigor when we address this question. So if you give inspirational statements and yet not at the end of it, right, they can mean so many different things that people can have totally different approaches to the subject and yet all agree on the same slogan. Okay, yes?
Well, it depends on what you tell the truth about life. In other words, empirical truth. About
time, for example, then that would have to argue,
everybody would
agree that
that changes over time as you
interpret
it.
Sure.
If theoretical truth, that's when you get
the
popularly a concept
that
comes with the theory of
the theory. Good. We'll go through all those. I want to say, I'll go through all those. That's what I'm going to do in the lecture generally, is to go through all those approaches, try and understand and talk about their advantages and disadvantages, and then, give you a sense of where I come from personally. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is define definition. So the title of the lecture this last year is Should Facts Affect Faith? And those terms are already noted. So I want, for the purposes of the next 45 minutes, I want to define the term fact and faith. Okay, so that's the second, quote unquote, record. The sheet is a definition of fact and a definition of faith. Okay, the definition of fact I'm using is the fact is the necessary outcome of a compelling extra-religious epistemology. Okay, we'll start with this. Does everyone know what epistemology means?
No.
Okay, we'll start with this. Epistemology. Epistemology is the way you know something. Okay, so for example, right, every discipline has its own epistemology, and right, Judaism, on its own terms, has many different epistemologies. Right? We have Midrash Halakha, which is the way in which we know what Torah means to law. Right, we have Pshat, which is a totally different epistemology, which we supposedly sort of know what God meant when he talked to our Midbar, whatever time it is. Right, there are many different modes of thinking within each discipline. So I'm going to define a fact for these purposes without telling you whether it's true or not. Right, so I'm not making a statement. I'm just saying a fact is when there's a methodology that isn't internal to Judaism. Right, it doesn't come to you from a religious perspective. And you look and you say, well, that's a methodology that I find compelling. Right? When I know things through that method, I think that is knowledge. And this is an outcome that I think if you take that methodology, you have to reach that conclusion. Okay? Right, that's the experience. So I'm not I'm not, it may be that we have very different conceptions of what quote unquote facts are. Right? It may be, for example, that you find astrology. You find astrology a really compelling methodology. And so if you read in the Daily Horoscope, it says that today would be a very bad day to enter into a new relationship, right? That for you is a fact. Because somebody used a compelling epistemology, astrology, and reached a conclusion that you think is necessary, that for you is a fact. Now for me, that's nonsense. Right? But in terms of your religious approach, that's a fact. Yes?
On the philosophical distinction between
police based on empirical
evidence and
empiricism. Empirical evidence, right, that's a really loaded term. I don't want to go there. All right. Empiricism, right, which is the notion that your sense data or right, your sense data for some reason is reliable even though you know that you dream.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I'm just wondering between, like, empiricism is not 100%
sure,
but
it's
very, very likely that it's true.
That's your position.
Whereas
I think astrology is that way, or chemistry.
Exactly.
I believe in astrology because I look at history and I see, look, it's always come true.
That's not 100% true.
That's your, again, you gotta get away from the notion that you know, right, that you have, that your epistemologies are true and you have your opinion.
Everything is 100% true. You can't,
all epistemologies, right, you can never justify an epistemology. Okay, right, this is the, I hope I don't send you a philosophical crisis. How many of my friends go into crisis when they first start thinking, how do I know logically that logic works? Or, what are the odds of the probability of truth? you have a good modern bias towards certain types of thinking, right? You think that it's more important, for example, to study the way in which orbits are affected as they appear in sunny glass tubes. Right, and then our transmitted through various computers, right? You think that's more useful for figuring out orbits than it is to meditate about how God is perfect and a circle is perfect and therefore all orbits must be circular. Right, you know, that doesn't make any sense to you. But 300 years ago, right, the notion that you could come up with a vision of the world in which planets move in funny little shapes, because of your evidence, right, that would be nonsensical because it makes no sense. How could you have a world that is against reason? Reason teaches us that circles are perfect and God is perfect. I think it's important to have that conversation to realize because that's what teaches you, for example, that the Rambam is mostly useless for this conversation, even though people like to quote Rambam. I will quote him as a right myself. Because the Rambam notion of what a fact is something derivable from reason, right? And empirical data which contradicts reason is definitionally wrong. Right, whereas we work on the presumption that reason is fallible, right, and empiricism is the fundamental epistemology of modern. Right, so again, that's what I wanted to say, that a fact is whatever you think is a necessary result of what you think to be a compelling epistemology which is not grounded in religion. Now you have, right, if you think empiricism is that with you.
Okay,
well let's hold up for now. Okay, and suppose the thing. Right, faith is what one takes as a necessary outcome of a compelling religious epistemology. Okay, so for example, I may believe that a compelling religious epistemology is that I am the kliyas to believe whatever is the consensus of the Orthodox community currently is philosophically. Okay, and so that, right, so I will have faith in whatever it is that the Orthodox community currently believes to be binding faith. So for example, I may take the position that I have faith that every letter of the Torah is exactly the way it was given by God to Moses at Sinai. Now what grounds that methodology, that belief will not be Emunah and Chazal, because Chazal doesn't seem to fall the position in Chazal. It's not Emunah and the Rishonim, because there seems to be traditions that are shown that at least some letters, right, there are differences. But it's a reasonable approximation of much contemporary Orthodox theology. So I may find that a necessary result of a compelling religious epistemology. I may think that a compelling religious epistemology is that whatever halakha tells me, I have to believe. Okay, so when I talk about faith means something that I think using a religious method of knowing things, right, this is the only outcome you can have. Okay, so when I talk about whether past affects faith, the question I'm asking is, right, can I ever have something which I arrive at as I arrive at thinking is true because I thought in ways outside my religion? Right? And can that change anything that I start off thinking is true because I thought about it through religion? That's the end.
This is very fair. Is this comparable to an idea that I follow this posture rather than that one, because I believe in psychology, one sense of knowledge is...
Well, I think the key word is necessary, right? Like, I might follow Sotsa Gage against Sotsa Gage, but I think Sotsa Gage is usually right.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't require me to believe that he's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very non-necessary outcome.
Okay.
Necessary outcome is when it can't be any other way. Okay, in the same way, right, that if I find it probable, that the universe is expanding. Right, looking at contemporary cosmology, it seems to me that the Big Bang Theory is probable. But It's still a real possibility that the Big Bang Theory will be replaced by a static universe theory. So then it's not a fact that the universe is expanding. Right? It's a nice outcome, but it's only probabilistic. It's not, right? It's not a fact.
Only
that it has to be that way.
No.
It's a necessary outcome. Necessary, right? The key word is fact. No, for my reason, the fact is only a necessary outcome. So long as I consider another possibility to be a reasonable product of the same methodology, it's not a fact.
But there might not be any fact.
There might not be any fact in certain cases, right? Methodologies are absolutely probabilistic, right? And there are no facts.
But in terms of the expanding universe, more than a consensus.
I've been reading some sort of theoretical stuff lately, so there's another model which might explain.
It's a very small model.
Okay, good. You might, right, so now we have to debate what our cosmological methodologies are, right? Do we say that a compelling outcome is what most cosmologists believe, 95% of cosmologists believe, or all cosmologists believe? Okay, good. So now we have to have cosmological conflict within cosmology, that's fine. I'm talking about within each person's psychology. So for me, there are no cosmological facts. Right? For you, there are. It might be, on the other hand, that for me, there are archaeological facts. And for you, there aren't. Right? All the time, psychologically, right, each of us has disciplines that we are attracted to outside of religion. Right? And we have varying degrees of confidence in the outcomes of those disciplines. If we think those outcomes are necessary, then we have a fact. And you can pick your discipline, I say. For you, it's cosmology and has certain facts, right? And for other people, astrology has certain facts, or palmistry, or archaeology, or even, God help us, sociology.
If you use the same argument style for faith, then there is no faith, because your concept of Thomas Kahn is different from this concept of Thomas Kahn, which is different from this. So therefore, there isn't a certainty, and using the same argument is used for fact, therefore there is no necessary outcome.
Good. So the easy way to claim that, to avoid all conflict, is to claim that there are no necessary outcomes with anything.
Well, maybe your definition.
No, it also is not. I would suggest that for most of us, probably, there are. It's true that you have made a fan of them all, we'll talk about that. But most of us, for example, are convinced that the religious epistemology of Torah requires us to believe in a God who created the world. And most of us think that that's a necessary outcome of our religious epistemology. Okay, and most of us believe that a necessary outcome.
The fact that you say that most.
That's true. That doesn't matter to me because I believe necessary. No. Necessary. I can find it psychologically necessary. I find it psychologically necessary. Okay, right? Most of us probably believe also that it's a necessary outcome of scientific methodology that the Earth is not at the center of the universe in any meaningful sense. And the scientists are the scientists have the Earth and round, right? The scientists are the Flat Earth Society. It doesn't change the fact that for me, the circularity, the spherical-ness of the Earth is a fact. Right? But nonetheless, it's a Flat Earth Society. I also don't believe the backside of the moon is made of green cheese.
Right, or props put up by Hollywood to right, the moonshot, even though there are people who believe that. You can find all these fun things on Hollywood.
Okay. I do have certain facts about scientific collisions, but those aren't among them. Okay. Now, so as most of you get, right, so the trick for dealing with most conflict is to eliminate the category necessary. And the standard strategy when you deal specifically with science and religion is to claim that science has no necessary outcomes in the realm of values, and religion has no necessary outcomes in the realm of facts. Right? To explain that, right? You could have science can never really tell you that you have to believe that, or you have to believe that the fittest should survive. Right, and religion can never absolutely tell you that, right, human beings were created in a particular fashion. Right, and so if you read a standard approach to science and religion, particularly from scientists who are very eager not to appear to be against religion, or from rabbis who are very eager not to appear to be on Mars, right, usually the approach you have is this complete separation in which you say that science has its sphere, religion has its sphere, and they never, on the realm of necessity, they never conflict. Right? Okay, you can find it in Julius Huxley, I think, in the original evolution debate, right? Just forcefully over and over again. You know, why should anyone perceive there being a conflict between science and religion? Science deals with facts, it doesn't deal with values, there is no conflict. Yes?
And I guess this kind of gets to the position that they go against, which they have, but don't you all have the sign for religion that religious are? I mean, you're using the definition of fact and faith. The only difference is really whether you're working with a religious epistemology or a current epistemology. So I think if you're religious, you might think of
it. Very good. We're going to get to that note. Okay, I got this skeptic because I'm ready for. Okay. So I want to just give you, a bit of the history. So one of the obvious problems with this division is the concept of natural law. Natural law is the notion that one can deduce the right values from that. And because the cat is tanua, therefore we should be tanua, because the ant is busy, therefore we should be busy. That's the caricature that comes from a particular set of these statements. You know, more often it would be that we can derive something about the importance of family from the universality of human feeling. And this is a very powerful movement, and is once again a very powerful movement for Supreme Court justices. Right? The notion that the way the universe is, in fact, is a source of information about values. Okay, right. Traditionally, it taught people the notions of family. Then, when one point, if social Darwinism came along and it taught you about the importance of survival, and people derived the importance of survival as the primary value, which you can of course read back into skill methods, so the colors are cool, and you have to figure out why those are really different. Okay, the response to natural law, which is what generates the division, is David Hume's famous statement from id to op. Or in other words, from facts to values, there is no inference. Okay, so Hume basically says no. Right, and this is the piece on natural law has a very nice, illusionary why do we learn fear from facts? Right? Why don't we learn hatred of mice? Why do we learn dignity from ants, right? You know, instead of what we should learn is the importance of having a hive mind as opposed to an individual. So nowadays it is the notion that you can move naively from saying this is the way the world is to this is what we ought to do, right? Tends to be in disrepute, although there are particular, again, Justice Thomas is particularly into this. In Jewish philosophic circles, David Novak, I think, is the primary opponent right now of explicit natural law perspective. I hope I'm not distorting his position. So the position that is threatened is the notion, right, is this separation, because of Hume between his and ought, and say that, so why should we care what science says? After all, we can derive values. Now here's where I want to introduce a notion which has less popular currency right now, but was at one point very philosophically valuable, and I still find it significant. And this is the idea of falsifiability. Okay, falsifiability, which means, okay,
but yes, the word meaning there is a noun, not a...
Right, not falsifiability, which means that falsifiability says, in this version, right, in the version I'm using it, that meaning, in order for a statement to be meaningful, it has to have enough meaning. Okay, it has to have a practical, something else has to change because we believe it. Okay, so for example, if I get up and I make the statement, and I say, all blicks are green. Now, that doesn't affect anything else, right? I can debate all blicks are green is compatible with any other statement in the world because there are no blicks. Alright, so the statement all blicks are green is meaningless. So it affects nothing whatsoever. Okay, so now, the question is, do we really want to make the claim that religious statements, right, are compatible with any statement about the world? Right, that religious statements are unfalsifiable. Nothing that happens can in any way affect my religious statement. So for example, I will take the faith position based on my religious epistemology that God rewards the righteous and right and punishes the wicked. I will maintain that belief, even if it becomes right clear to me that the righteous tend to spend their days boiling excrement. And the wicked tend to spend their days and sit there in Sybaritic paradises being served by angelic harlot, whatever it may be. Right? And even if that turns out to me that is an eternal condition, right? Because human beings have become immortal. And it worked out that the righteous people always spend their days being well with excrement, right? So, you know, people, right, as, you know, when the definition of righteousness I use, and wicked people always spend their days in hedonistic paradises, that doesn't affect because God is just. Now, is the statement God is just meaningful? Is the statement God is just is compatible with a statement that the facts are that, right, that on average, righteous people spend more time boiling an excrement than wicked people, and wicked people spend, right, experience far more pleasure in their lives than righteous people. No. Right? All I'm doing then is I'm
saying you have all of that.
Yeah. Right? So in order for a statement to be meaningful, it has to say something about the world. Right? That's the counterclaim to Hume. Right? Today's philosophy with my friends is that religious statements which are not falsifiable, religious statements which are compatible with anything else are meaningless. Okay, so to make the claim, so for example, I say that God created the world. And my statement that God created the world is compatible with any possible conclusion of cosmology. It's compatible with a statement that matter is eternal and the universe has always existed. It's compatible with a statement that the universe once was a tiny singularity and expanded and blew up and it's going to shrink again. It's, right, it's compatible with anything you want. Right? But I believe God created the world. Does the statement God created the world have any meaning? No, it has no meaning. Because if there's nothing, right, if there's nothing about the world which can right, if there's no statement about the world which can contradict the statement God created the world, and the statement God created the world is meaningless. Okay? Right, so I want to take that as an important counter criteria. I need to move toward the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It has to, right, it has to be falsified. It has to be some other statement, which you say, if that statement is true, then this statement is false. Okay, it's something other than simply the negation. God did not create the world, because that's equally meaningless statement if it doesn't affect anything else. Okay.
Is it such as understanding your text? I only have 22 minutes left, so I want to move on, okay?
These are obviously lifetime conversations, and hopefully you'll take my card and you'll start a lifetime conversation.
Okay.
So now, what I want to point out is not only is this true in the realm of philosophy, that the statement being meaningful has to have enough communism, so it's not really a good position to take that we don't care what science says. So saying we don't care what science says means that many of our faith positions become meaningless. Also, the distinction between fact and value in terms of Judaism breaks down in a very particular way, because if you claim that religion says nothing about the world, then halakha vanishes.
because what law requires the capacity to determine both facts and values. So I give you one that I think is probably the most dangerous in our shop. For those of you who are not worthy of learning it, please forget it immediately after our edition. This is a Gemara on Gizalos Gatsani Benamal, and that way this is my traditional course this year. So I can meet that like the Moshe Bernstein criteria that every class you should be able to make a go to the Torah. That'd be great. So there's a bright side Gizalos Gatsani Benamal, which says, if the court rules that the sun is set and that the Shabbat was over, we will still Zarcha, and the end of sun shines, Ein Zuhor Ra'ah Ela Ta'ud. This is not a halakhic ruling at all, it's a mistake. And therefore, if you violate Shabbat, even though Beit Din told you that Shabbat was over, tough on you. You have to bring your own sacrifice, your own korban. Because, who cares what Beit Din said the sun said it didn't? Now, let's think about how this plays out in legal terms. Okay, a guy comes into the right to Beit Din, and the witness testifies that he shot somebody, that somebody is now dead, and so he's trying to convict him of murder. And he says, hang on a sec, you say that the person died because I shot them with a bullet, but I believe that they died because the demon smoked them. And it just happens that the demon smoked them at the exact same time that my bullet is there. Well, I believe they weren't really human beings, they were a positronic robot that had been created by a super race around the universe for years. I was telling them to pre-human race from the tyranny of positronic robots. Now, I can only convict them. The only way law only works is I can both say this is what you should have done. Red law says this is what you should do in particular situations. But in order to impose law on you, I have to be able to say this is the situation, and therefore that's what you should have done. Right? If I want to claim the law is that it's not to eat pork, but each of you decide to say that's not pork, that's terrible. This is the red law meaning. That's why this Gemara in principle undermines the whole capacity for halakha to function. It is really true that court's rulings on facts are insignificant. Right, that also breaks down, because I can just say, no, I have to eat that, because you thought it right, you guys think it's pork, but I know better. I know it's not pork, I know that really, it was the second roll which I needed to have the mission on Shabbos until it was the next one. Right? So law only makes sense. Law only makes sense. If you can determine legally facts as well as value. Right? So the fact-value distinction only works if you believe that religion should not be able to have law. If you believe in halakha, if you believe religion should have a legal system, then you can't accept the fact-value distinction. Okay. But, just because religion has to have facts, right, doesn't mean that the fact religion has a right to determine has to come from a religious epistemology. I could take the position that religion requires me to accept whatever science determines as fact and to act accordingly. Right? Whatever scientists tell me is pork, by DNA evidence, whatever it may be, that's what I'm not allowed to eat. Okay, now there are always cases where that is not true. There are all cases, and we'll talk about this in the month of which here. Right, there are cases, for example, if we decided that what Dhammita was based on chemical analysis, we would all be in a lot of trouble. If we decided that the way in which we decide the facts of Dhammita are based on science as opposed to based on tradition. But let's suppose that generally it is possible to take the position that just because religion has the capacity as an exception to determine facts from the realm of halakha, doesn't mean that the way in which you arrive at the facts of halakha are because of any kind of internal halakhic epistemology. They claim that the facts to which halakha applies are the facts of science, and accepting halakha as binding is that I accept science as binding, right, in terms of definitions of reality. And then I am obligated to apply halakhic rules to reality as science gives it to me. Okay, now there are a number of traditional approaches which completely reject this. The two classic halakhic cases for approaches rejecting this position are one, the medieval controversy about trefos, traits that are defined philosophically as animals that have a wound that would cause them to die within a year. The difficulty with this is that not only are they defined that way, there's also a list of examples that illustrate those. And it was a pretty rapid discovery after Gemara that guess what? These animals aren't dying within a year. Okay, and that caused a whole controversy, right? Because we have examples of halakha that don't conform to what science tells us at all. And it's still an art issue because, for example, many milk cows are trachos by the definition of having punctures, because in order to keep the cows alive, there's an operation by which they insert a needle into the stomach to remove the gas, because the way we treat dairy cows now, their cow's stomach is oil and exploded. If we didn't puncture their stomach and let the gas out, so that makes them a trachos because they're old. Now, it's kind of a deep irony to say that you're made a trachos, right, which means you're going to die within a year by an operation which is routinely conducted by veterinarians to keep animals alive, so otherwise they would die. Right, so that creates a certain amount of cognitive contradiction. But in the Middle Ages, they were already perfectly aware that these animals were having the annoying habit of not being dead. And this caused all sorts of controversy. The second issue, right, but maybe even more dramatic than that, is the case of a young woman who is a very, very young woman, right? She is 2 years and 12 months old. And at that point she has a sexual encounter which breaks the hymen. And so since the rule is 2 years and 12 and a half months old, and so the rule is halakhically that we rule that if the hymen is broken before a woman is 3 years old, then the hymen regrows, and therefore the woman is still considered a tuwa for halakhic purposes. But if the hymen is broken after 3 years old, right, then the hymen does not regrow and the woman is not a tuwa. Right? So before 3 years old, the tuwa tera chotros. After 3 years old, the tuwa tera chotros. Okay, so fine, because we'll worry about that. The problem is, what happens if, or it depends on the time what happens if, after the sexual encounter, which is 2 years and 12 and a half months, the baby declares a leap year. And now it turns out that it's a 13-month year. So at the time of the sexual encounter, she was 3 years old, because we thought that it was her birthday, but it turned out it wasn't her birthday at all. And her birthday is a month from now. So now what happens to her physically? The two of them goes right or not. Right? So there is a medieval physician gland in modern era which rules that, guess what? The two of them goes right now. They wouldn't have, right? The decision that basically makes as to whether or not to make this a leap year determines what happens to her visitor. And now that is a position which presumes that halakha determines the test. Okay, right? Halakha is a determination of both facts and values, and no matter how absurd it seems to us, right, you know, to claim that whether or not a particular right, bodily part regenerates in the exact same physical circumstance from year to year depends on whether or not a group of rabbis gets up and decides to make the month 13 years or not. Right? Or for the same token, right, it might be that we would say, right, again, I don't know if you don't know Pirate Dependence. The thought of Pirate Dependence is somebody who's indentured until his 18th birthday, but he's born on February 29th. Okay, so you can imagine, right, somebody perhaps, you know, somebody would rule, right, you know, if we use the vector calendar, that the telephone runs until she is 12 years old. Right, if she's born on February 29th. Right, all the days, but what happens if she's born on Dark Shady? Right, you rule it that way, okay? So there is a positional philosophy which rules that halakha is the only epistemology, right, always the great, if the animals aren't dead, well, that's right, they really should be dead, and we have to find some way of explaining either they're not really, they don't really have function, or they're really exceptional, and there are lots of animals which are dying, and these are peculiar exceptions. Or, similarly, that people take the approach that, in fact, it's a metaphor. But while these statements have real appeal, and therefore there are people who take it as a necessary outcome of religious epistemologists, that anything halakha determines to be, all the factual assumptions of halakha have to be true. There is a position in halakha which is very different. It usually comes from a Gemara which is source number 5, right, in which there is a controversy about there's a controversy about whether the sun goes above the Rakia or below the Earth at night. And happily, Rebbe can state that the phases of the rest of the world are more correct than they, and that in fact the sun goes under the Earth at night as opposed to over the Rakia. Okay, now both of these are built on geocentric universe models, so we wouldn't accept either of them, but it's generally taken as a model of great intellectual honesty, but you see that in fact that all were not committed to their scientific conclusions, even if all has previously been based on them. Right, and so that seems to be a support of the notion that we have no necessary outcomes in the halakhic fact. I just want to point out, this is source number 6, which you can read yourself later, that it's very weird, this is one of the remarks, ironically, those people who like to take modern science, right, like to take this more literally. Right, because look, you see them as a real scientific dispute, and they have their position, and we are position already conceded. But the truth is, almost all these dialogues are allegories. And so I gave another conversation with Rebbe Antoninus, which also looks like a scientific dispute, but it will be obvious to immediately they're not talking about science, because the arguments they make wouldn't have been scientific in any model whatsoever. And the truth is that almost all the dialogues between phages and non-Jewish figures in the Talmud are allegories, and you have to unlock the allegories, and it may have nothing whatsoever to do with science and religion controversies. I just mentioned that as an aside. I would be very leery about quoting these texts as evidence. The problem with the notion that the halakha just accepts science as such, right, and halakha doesn't have independent epistemology, is that science keeps changing. And so that means that we have to concede that in the past, when people followed halakha, they did things that were actually wrong. Because in the past, the right people came to halakhic conclusions based on science of their day, right, and it turns out that science was incorrect. And that's a very difficult thing to say, right, to say that, right, so we no longer... It means that even in our day, we can't take the condition that I'm always going to do the right thing because halakha tells me to, because halakha might be wrong. It might be that halakha is telling me that I should do halakha now, but really Shabbat is over. Really Shabbat is over. Now you can respond to that by taking what we call the positivist position in law, which is to say that your obligation is to call halakha as such. And it doesn't matter whether halakha yields doing the right thing. That's also not a position you want to take. Right? I call halakha. If halakha tells me to kill somebody because if I don't kill, right, because if I don't, let's suppose, right, there's somebody coming towards me, and if somebody's coming towards me with a needle, which they're going to puncture my, right, which is going to make me a traitor. Right? And so, so the halakha tells me I have to get up and kill them, because they're about to kill me. Now, it happens that, so that really, medically, they're not going to kill me, they're not going to turn me into a traitor at all. Medically, they're going to save my life. But halakha, after all, tells me, right, that they're going to make you. Right, we don't really want to take the position that we just follow halakha is right, and it doesn't matter what halakha yields the empirically correct conclusion as long as it did what the law tells me to do.
That's the vision of the Catholic Church. If you did what we told you to do, even if we later are changed for our homework, you're still
right. And there are many Orthodox thinkers. I would say that the predominant mode in Orthodox thinking right now is positivist. And it's just said that all that matters is what the law is, and it doesn't matter whether the law is right or not. I think it's a very dangerous position. We should want all of this to be right. Okay, so my overall take is that it's probably a bad idea to take the position that halakha always, that halakha is the only epistemology that matters in terms of facts, because you end up A, doing things that are wrong, and B, feeling ridiculous a lot of the time. On the other hand, the notion that halakha doesn't care, right, seems to be to undermine the whole notion of halakha, and you have to find some kind of balance between giving, right, some kind of meaning to halakha's fact statement, while on the other hand, not tying yourself to them permanently. Okay, but I want to acknowledge that all this is something of a red herring. Because when we talk about conflicts in fact and faith now, most people are not bothered by conflicts between fact and halakha. But for example, the conflicts they have are not between the science and the legal outcomes of halakha, but between science and other forms of external epistemologies and the premises of halakha. Right, so when people talk about Shasakta's like faith, they're really talking about how does contemporary academic scholarship affect our notion of the divine authorship of Torah? How do the results of other epistemologies affect our positions on the historical accuracy of Jewish tradition, biblical and rabbinic? How does the results of other epistemologies affect our positions about the uniqueness of humanity? How do other epistemologies affect our belief on divine oversight and management of the world? When people talk about issues in fact and faith, it's usually not on the level of halakha. I'm using that mostly to illustrate options, but it really deals with premises. Now, how do you approach that? So if you are, right, the one approach is simply to say that all epistemologies are subject to the Ikari Emuna, right, and therefore there are no right facts to never affect faith because the outcomes of religious epistemologies are always controlling, and your job is just to figure out, right, you just figure out whether you can accept the others or reject them. So even if you're functioning as a scientist, right, the reason I'm not afraid of truth is because I have truth. And I have truth of the capital T, you have truth of the lowercase t. If your truth lowercase t contradicts my truth capital T, then I'm equity. It's not going to bother me. And I have some kind of experience that convinces me that Torah is divine. All the scholarship in the world has said otherwise doesn't affect it. That's one law. The right that you might call nowadays is largely what would be stereotypically called the Haredi model. Right? Then there's a counter approach, which we will stereotypically call the modern Orthodox model. Now that I come across as a reasonable benefit. Is to say, no. What we do is we say that obviously religion commits us to nothing whatsoever. Right, and so we're not afraid of truth because whatever the results of those other epistemologies are, we can live with it. Right? So this is where this year you get up and you quote the Rambam and say that if Aristotle has proven to me the eternity of the universe, right, I would have reinterpreted the sword of action and say, guess what? If I can make Rashid Bar Elohim compatible with the notion that matter is eternal, I can do anything. Okay, this is the kind of approach you will find in the work, right, the generally very informative work of Rabbi Plotkin. Right, but the point is to minimize the necessary conclusions of religion, and to say also that we don't really believe anything. We just right, there's no such thing really as faith. There are just tentative statements until they run into the results of other epistemologies. Now, this is my worst parsing a little bit. For example, let's take the notion of the eternal universe. That matter is always existing. What happens now? Is it a necessary? Is Rambam right that it is not a necessary conclusion of Chumash to believe that God created the world Yeshmei? Okay, so now it turns out in terms of Pshat and Chumash, the Rambam is absolutely right because most Rishonim don't think that Bereshit Bara Elokim means Briah Yeshmei. Right, that's the philosophic imposition of the text. Because most Rishonim are deeply impressed by the fact that it says the artifact is Tohu Mavo. And that seems to mean that there was Tohu Mavo originally. Right? And where did the word come from? Right? So Pshat Chumash, creation ex nihilo, is really not a necessary. If your religious epistemology is Pshat Chumash, then it's not a necessary outcome. But what happens to our conception of Shabbat? The religious life we live, in terms of Shabbat, it makes sense if we don't believe in Briah Yeshmei. Okay? The real question is, right, to what degree, right, are there assumptions that ground our religious experience that if they were to change, our religious experience would be so radically different that it wouldn't be recognizable as the same thing anymore? Okay, to make the claim that I can interpret that if you said that the only epistemology necessary for religion is that it be compatible with the text. And then to make a claim that I can make a text whatever I want. And we're Humpty Dumpty with regard to an authority. We can make an authority mean exactly what we exactly want it to mean. Is that really meaningful to say that we are loyal to any, that we have a religion? If a religion has no necessary outcome. All the only test we have is, can we make this fit with the text of Chumash? there's a Star Trek episode in which there's a war at the end between the Klons and the Yangs, and it turns out the Yangs are faithful to the Declaration Declaration of Independence, but they've completely forgotten what it meant. Right? So there's a totalitarian dictatorship. Right? But in the end, right, when he gets up and he says, no, it's not, you know, it's not whatever nonsense you thought, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, all the third reason, oh! Right, and they all go back to, right, and they all go back to being liberal Democrats. It's not, right, issues, right, it's loyalty, right, it's the loyalty to a text. Right, or to a history, whatever your terminology going is, and that a meaningful statement, if in fact you are not, there is nothing you're committed to, right, so, you know, whatever it is that I now take as the outcome of my religious epistemology, they'll all change as long as you can make them fit the text. And I think anything can fit the text. Right, you fail to falsify the text, and your results are meaningless. Okay, it's the outcome. All right, so I need to finish. And you can read, Berman has a very interesting article with the exposition that is quoted largely in full here, which he takes what I think you put earlier for the Averroist position, which is to say, look, I can say this is my religious truth, and that's my scientific truth, or my academic, the Bible truth, whatever it may be, and I don't know how they're compatible yet, and I can live with both of them, as long as when there's a practical difference, I follow all of it. I don't have to believe, I have to follow all of that. If it's true, and I can hold it, and I can suspend the question of whether the fantasies are true or not, as long as they enable me to follow all of them. Right? There are Vermin's taking me one useful way of doing that. What maybe in the medieval times was called the Averroist position, which I have come to more appreciation of than I used to. Averroist. Averroist. From Ibn Rushd, which is an Islamic philosopher who came up with it. Here's my, right, what I hope comes out of here is that you should all be, you all understand that there is no simple answer to this question, right? So you have to find a way that you've read, to commit yourself absolutely to statements kind of religious epistemology means that your statements are really vulnerable, and you know, and past experience doesn't work too well because most of the statements you've committed yourself to 500 years ago aren't true anymore. On the other hand, to say in advance I have no commitment means that you don't really believe anything. My take is that our awareness of what I would call the endemic transience of scientific truth, right? We know that science keeps changing its mind, and the historical contingency of the social scientific truth means that the kind of notion that Rahman Rastanigon had, which is that Torah can't never tell us to believe what is against reason, so we always have to immediately interpret Torah in the face of that, I don't think that's true. We don't have this case in science, and certainly not in social science or theology or any of those, that the Rambam had reason. I don't think that there's always been clear to me that the Rambam and the Sadiq have always been true. There have always been people in which they're perfectly happy believing things that appear apparently ridiculous in their time. Right? You have to be willing to maintain on top of their positions. Right? We do not believe, we don't think that the church, the historians that credo to sort of mess, the more variety believe it because it is absurd, but it's also not a Jewish credo, a non-credo to sort of mess. I refuse to believe it just because it doesn't seem sensible right now. We lose nonsensical things. In the end of the disputation in fact, the Taylor Paris apparently turned to the Christians when they say one really problematic measures, and he said, look, you guys believe so many ridiculous things. Can't we have just one? Oh, we have the idea. Right, we said we are less happy believing things that appear absurd. So we not on occasion taken positions like that. So what I would end up saying is that on the one hand, I am not a fan of the notion that we should immediately rush to make Judaism compatible with whatever the epistemologies of other disciplines say. Right? We should have historical perspective and know that, right, that if we had bent religion to match cosmology 60 years ago, they would have a religious conception that would look like nonsense now, right? Because the Big Bang Theory looked like nonsense 6 years ago, no one believed it. Now all of a sudden, right? We should have, the Torah should give us the historical perspective not to change immediately. On the other hand, it would be unwise to commit ourselves absolutely and say, well, I know this is going to change, because some truths really seem to be, right, really seem to be embedded in. It's unlikely we're going to go back to believing that diseases are caused by humans as opposed to by their spirits. Right, even though, right, you can always maintain the position that, right, that the reason that bacteria are always found in diseases is that demons eat bacteria. Right, that's why we have to find bacteria in the presence of diseases, and eventually we'll discover that really when we treat bacteria, we're only treating the symptoms, because the demons go away when their food is gone. And if we really want to treat the disease, we have to treat the demons. And it's unlikely we're going to go back to believing that, and so committing ourselves to a demon-fearing disease seems to me deeply unlikely. So what I end up suggesting is a position I would call soft falsifiability. Right, that we should maintain our religious beliefs fairly strongly. They should be resistant to change in the faith, right? To change in the faith of the results of other epistemologies. And again, you make your own evaluation of which epistemologies you find compelling. Right? Some of you may find science more compelling, some of your archaeology, some of your biblical criticism, and some of your astrology. And that when there is a conflict, a strong conflict is probably why we got some kind of double truth position in the short run, which is to say, I don't know how to handle this, and so I'm going to follow up for now, as best I can. And in the hope, usually, that there will be some way that somebody will find a way of making them compatible, but it's unwise to make any decision absolute. Because then you end up having to change your mind. And hopefully the maintenance of religious positions that have resistance to our false facts, even though in the end they're not going to break under the weight of any single fact, is enough to make the religious position meaningful. Thank you very much for your attention to the sorry to take business cards, by the way. If you need a combination or just see the other stuff on the website, etc.
We have newer rules, but we still navigate a new, we still navigate by new rules. Right? So sometimes it's a matter of looking at outcomes. In other words, if I'm looking for a certain outcome, it almost doesn't matter. If I believe that disease is caused by demons and by cure rate is comparable to somebody else.
They give you a pragmatist and say, underline the legion, I think. It has to be incompatible with another statement. And if a statement can be true no matter what else you say, Again, you can make the claim that all the Holocaust, all of us, tomorrow is going to be a positive and I'll in favor of helping the oppressor against the oppressed. There are not any values underlying it, but it matters to us. All that matters is I don't like that position.
The position you're taking is that
some of us are sick, and some of us are not. And I would say the same, you know, all of us are sick, but some of us are more sick than others. I haven't read it yet.
I think the use of all the presentation needs to allow me to understand what you're attempting to clearly establish. First, we've done that for one year. The original dissertation and the first use of itself in the 38th chapter, along their key parallel tracks that they apply, arguing they're incompatible, but I couldn't understand how you're attempting to.
I was trying to point out positive things mean superior knowledge and exterior knowledge, where exterior knowledge is more flexible, you don't know what absolute certainty is based on a critical premise, whereas some things which are a priori are absolute certain, such as the logic which you can't think without.
Right. Well, it doesn't mean they're true. It doesn't mean you can't think without
that. thing is, the question remains whether we know religion as, a priori or a priori. And I think the biggest problem is that religion can't be known a priori. So, that shows that, you have to sort